pilot.
Pilot? What's a pilot?
Well, the way they pick TV shows is they make one show. That show's called a pilot. And they show that one show to the people who pick shows. And on the strength of that one show, they decide if they want to make more shows. Some get chosen and become television programs. Some don't. Become nothing. She starred in one of the ones that became nothing.
All right, we're back after a brief hiatus. And ironically enough, one of us was a little sick in between our last series of pilots and the one we're about to start talking about. You know, we're about to begin a series on medical drama or medical genre pilots. And, you know, funny enough, Keith, I hope it's okay if I share you were a little ill. I won't get into specifics, but I'm glad that you're healthy and maybe a little TV is going to be good medicine for you.
I would have loved it if one of these television doctors helped me. No, I got a simple stomach bug or however it kind of came up. I think I got it at the movie theater. I saw Dune and it's the only place it could have happened. The movie's credit, the film was packed. But yeah, no, that the next day, like the, you know, you started, all the symptoms started coming and I have not been sick since college when the last time I got a stomach bug. So I never really took sick days or I try not to. I don't know how to be sick. I always feel like I should be doing something or like, you know, it was nice to have like broth.
Mm-hmm. You probably just needed 50 cc's of something.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Maybe as we go through these medical genre shows, you could maybe at the end pick which doctor you'd like to become a patient of that you know, next time you get sick, who you'd want to treat you.
That's a good game. That's right? A good game to play. Maybe, yeah.
Depending on, I guess, like what exactly you're sick with. But yeah, here we are. First of all, I'm glad that you're feeling better.
Thank you.
And we're able to get back to it to discuss TV pilots. And yeah, so I always felt that the medical genre was something that's been very prevalent in TV throughout all the different decades. So much so that our first pilot that we're going to be discussing is the oldest one that we've discussed so far. And that is the pilot of MASH. And that goes all the way back to 1972.
51 years ago.
Wow. Definitely a staple in TV history. One of the most... it's something that anybody who studied media is well aware of.
Yeah.
Right? It's just majorly influential and groundbreaking in a lot of respects. It was just monumental. And so what do you think, though, about shows about doctors and... You know, this profession. What do you think keeps bringing people back to these kinds of shows?
Well, with the shows that I think we're going to talk about is, one, doctors and getting sick or some aspect of just medicine and that area is a part of everyone's lives. Everyone has gone to a hospital for good reasons, bad reasons. People become doctors and they know doctors. So it's a part of our lives, and I think there's always going to be medical shows. I think what's good about that is then you could do unique things with that. You could do drama, you could do comedy, you could do mystery, you could do dramedy, you could do romance, you could do so many genres. It's like a genre within a genre.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? There's subgenres.
We haven't entered like science fiction or fantasy. I'd be curious if anything like that exists in like literature or anything, but there's a lot to mine. And it just, you know, sometimes it can go to the extreme, like these extreme case scenarios, but sometimes it's a simple, like just dealing with death. Like, it kind of helps us.
Yeah, it can be very existential at times because that is just a big part of the job when you work in a hospital. And yeah, you know, even the comedies of this genre have dramatic moments. It's hard not
to. Yeah, I was about to say, if you're doing a show about, like, you know, with these topics, of course you could be funny, but yeah, you're gonna have to be like, you're gonna have to take some things seriously.
Right, unless you're an outright parody, but otherwise you have shows that will be conventional comedies, but again, by the very nature of the profession that you're following, it's definitely going to get serious at times. And I think the other thing, too, that I like about these kinds of shows is that it humanizes a profession that I think quite often, as a person who's just a patient, when I go to the doctor or the hospital or something, you know, there's just kind of, yeah, patient. There's something to be said about a doctor with good bedside manner, and you get maybe get to know your doctors a little well. But quite often, as a patient, you maybe think too much about your doctor's day, like the other things they're going through, like what their personal life is. You know, when you're going to the doctor or the hospital, you're just really concerned about your own well-being. And, you know, the doctors come in and you rely on them to help you or, you know, do whatever that you need them to do. But maybe you don't quite think about what they were doing just before they met you or what they do right after your appointment with them. You know, what are they doing? You know, what's on their minds, at the back of their minds personally? And how does that, you know, affect their job? I think that's just something that it's like peeling back the curtain a little bit too. And also seeing how these hospitals are run, right? Like the politics of it, the bureaucracy, you know, just how that all is, I don't know, just something that as a patient you wouldn't normally consider. But yeah, so I think people are always going to be curious, and there's always going to be a lot more to say, especially when you look through the decades with the evolution of medicine and all the things that all the advancements that have been made. There's always going to be more material to bring out of this genre with time, as you know. I don't know, it kind of reflects the times too a lot when you look at shows throughout the decades. So that's a big thing with this show we're discussing too, MASH. I mean, it's a show that was premiered in the 70s, although it takes place in 1950 in the Korean War. And yeah, this is early 1970s when this comes out. And the 70s was just a whole different world when it came to television, you know, in terms of not just from having the three broadcast networks being so dominant, but also the style of television, the conventions, just how the, you know, the look of TV, the sound of TV. It's kind of fun to look back at a bygone era of television and see just like how shows were produced and structured.
No, I love going back in time just because it is kind of like a time machine. But I think with the 1970s specifically, that's when some really great ones came through. Mary Tyler Moore, All in the Family. That's when Norman Lear kind of really rocked television. Like just to bear witness to that. Like, yeah. I don't think people today really grasp the fact that people stayed home on Fridays and Saturdays, like must-see TV. Granted, they didn't have DVR or VHS at the time to record, but people stayed home to watch like Bob Newhart and All in the Family and all these shows just so that they wouldn't miss it. And that's why I think a lot of the baby boomers specifically, like, remember these cultural moments, there were some great like progressive moments for television, but just these memorable moments. And I know, like, through pop culture osmosis, that MASH produced a whole bunch.
Yeah, I think that as you're saying, from just how things were back then and how this medium of television didn't really have much competition going on with it except for film, these huge shows, like you mentioned, All in the Family, MASH, they were ubiquitous. They were just in people's homes, so much so that some people might feel like these characters are a part of their family to a degree. You get so invested in them, and it was just like the thing to do. There weren't as many channels of content to access back then, so of course people are going to be watching these shows just because, you know, it was just way more limited back then.
And as good, like, the best like Mary Tyler Moore ran for 7 seasons, All in the Family ran for 9, MASH ran for 11, producing about 250-something episodes. And, you know, of course, I'm sure people have ranked them. But that's, like we always say, back then, television just went until the ratings dipped or the quality. Like, that's such a testament to the show. Like, you know, it's kind, you know, of course, we talked about some of the big ones already. We talked about Friends, Seinfeld, Sopranos, Game of Thrones. But MASH, I think, definitely is on the Mount Rushmore of television. I think Alan Alda, Hawkeye's face is one of them. Because just how, like, I asked my parents, like, you know, of course, with all these shows, you get a set. You get a live studio audience. You don't get that with MASH. You get it does, you know, they're on their own set. They're, like, you get a laugh track that's used. How I Met Your Mother pilot, as great as that was, used the laugh track a little more. They were a little more loose with that.
Laugh track.
And it does flip through the tone, too. Yeah. It's not straight up comedy.
Yeah, you know, the laugh track is an interesting element of this. And being that so many comedies on TV before this, maybe all of them, I have to double check, were filmed in front of a live studio audience, right? You had that sitcom format on a soundstage. And here, clearly, there's not a studio audience watching this being filmed, but they still edit in a laugh track to this show. And I think, again, it's with the convention of the TV comedy. It was just all comedies on TV had a laugh track. And so, you know, the creators of the show, that they tried to insist on not having a laugh track. The network insisted.
Oh my God.
Came to a compromise where they wouldn't ever have a laugh track in the operating room scenes, which is fair. Try to be sensitive with that, even when the characters are joking around. But you still hear it. And to me, I wish they were able to be without a laugh track in this show, because it's a little distracting for me in hindsight. Although I'm sure in 1972, TV audiences were just used to it, and so it wouldn't have bothered them as much. But I could see, this show doesn't need it, but I think maybe the network was concerned, oh, maybe viewers won't know this is a comedy without a laugh track. There might have been a concern there, because it was just part of the definition of what it meant to be a comedy.
I think you're 100% right, because, okay, half hour comedy. That's it. Like, that, those are the rules. And things have become – the rules have been so bended by now. And I would say even MASH probably had a hand in bending the rules, because – I was reading, and I'm kind of interested to explore more on how the show evolved over the years, because they do say it started out as a straight up comedy and evolved into a dramedy. But yeah, it's so fascinating. And I was kind of thinking, like, I'm sure we're going to talk about Scrubs, and Scrubs, I felt like I was watching the 1970s version of Scrubs. It's like, you know, hospital dramatic moments. But Scrubs never had the laugh track. And I'm like, oh, imagine if Scrubs had a laugh track. How different. But, yeah, I think that's a sign that the times have changed.
Yeah, and other elements of the show, at least, were able to break the mold in the fact that it was filmed cinematically, very similar to the film. And so that being said, let's get into the pilot history here of MASH. So this show, the pilot aired on September 17th, 1972. It will be coming up on 52 years this September, which is really crazy, on CBS. And I couldn't find an exact viewership number, but I did see that it ranked 45th among telecasts on TV that week, which is low. But from what I understand, that initial first season time slot was something that hindered the show. It was a Sunday night slot, and it was going against some other heavy hitters. Like, apparently NBC had The Wonderful World of Disney on Sundays, and that was like a juggernaut in the ratings. So they had it was an unfortunate time slot that almost caused a short-lived run for the show. But
that's something, because
what almost would not have been right. But starting with the second season, CBS moved this the time slot for MASH to, I believe, Mondays after All in the Family. And so with All in the Family already being a really big success, that helped MASH grow its audience. And then what a night. I want to see what else was in that lineup on Mondays. But to have All in the Family and then MASH, I mean, you're having two of the most monumental TV shows airing back to back. I mean, it's like legacy programming right there.
And I think it should be said, even though we are a podcast that talks about pilots, that MASH is still the most watched finale by 106 million people.
Yes, 106 million people watched the finale in 1983. And actually, I believe that was like a two-hour special. It was like a movie almost, a TV movie. And it's the most watched scripted episode of TV of all time. And you'd be really hard-pressed to ever get anywhere near that number again just from how fragmented audiences are now. But, man, what a number to hold. I mean, that's more than most of the Super Bowls.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's like, unless you're a sporting event, I would like to dream, but I'm realistic. It's going to be hard to – yeah, damn near impossible. But I think that it's funny to go from 45th on a Sunday to one of the highest – finale of all time.
Yeah, that's the legacy of this show. So originally, MASH was a book that was written and published in 1968 by Richard Hooker, who was a doctor who worked in one of these Mobile Army Surgical Hospitals. That's what MASH stands for. And that book was adapted into the film, which was released in 1970 and starred Donald Sutherland. And that was also a very popular movie. And so I haven't watched the movie. Keith, I'm very certain that you probably have watched the movie. Am I correct?
I did. I watched it for the first time during COVID.
Okay. And is it necessary to have seen the film to watch the show?
No, but you'll go like, oh, there's similarity. Like, I mean, like you said, Donald Sutherland plays Hawkeye. Elliot Gould plays Trapper. And a very young, and I want to say breakthrough role for Robert Duvall as Frank.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. What a cast.
But if you're ever interested in Robert Altman, and I would ever interested in his style of films, definitely a one to watch. It's more like vignettes. Like,
okay.
It has the style of like, they're getting stuff done. But I always had to laugh that the movie ends with a 20-minute football game.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. It's kind of, well, I'm kind of laughing absurdly. I'm like, wow, like this is.
It's like a sports movie in that
regard.
Yeah,
this is what is going on? But it's it's anti-war. It's like, and so is the book, so is the TV show. But because Vietnam was going on at the time, all kind of said, okay, do Korea. That's kind of the forgotten war, which is a shame, but it is.
Yeah, so that's something that is good to consider contextually with the film and the show. The Vietnam War was still going on, and I think through the main character who Alan Alda plays in the show, Hawkeye, he is an anti-war character, right? It's like his perspective is he's against the war, he speaks out against it, but he still does his job, and he kind of voices some of the morality of the series. But from what I understand, after the Vietnam War had ended, then the show started to get a little less political and maybe focus more on the drama amongst the characters. But certainly, like, while this was airing, yeah, it was a very topical show because that was something that was just on everyone's mind at the time.
It's interesting to see that, like, the ever-changing cast. I think that also probably contributed to the show's, like, success and runtime. But like, oh yeah, like Alan Alda, I'm sure there's other actors. I wouldn't be surprised if Radar was on for the all 11 seasons. But I know Alan Alda was like heavily invested. Like, he became an executive producer. He became very he wrote a few episodes, I think like 19. He very much cared about this show. But yeah, no, it, like, you could go through, like, it's kind of like, you know, every year SNL puts out their cast photo. I would say like every 3 years it's like the cast switches.
The cast switched, the writing room changed, right? A lot of the creative voices changed. So the show goes through different eras. And from what I understand, it gets more dramatic as it goes on too. So I think by the end, especially the finale, which Alan Alda wrote, some very serious dark moments in it as well. So You can say this is a comedy based on the pilot, but certainly it's a show that maybe is on a spectrum that transitions from comedy to drama with each year.
In addition, like, you know, we were talking about like genres within genres. Not only is this, of course, the medical genre with a situational comedy, but there's also a war medical drama situational comedy.
Yeah, that's true. That because that could be enough, right? Just taking place during a war. But it's from the perspective of these doctors, these surgeons who are treating wounded soldiers. And so that's a very interesting perspective. They're not on the front lines, but they're still very vital to, you know, what was going on. So, yeah, so the series did want to adapt the cinematic look of the film. And so I think when you compare the film and the show, that you have its spirit, they're very similar. And so that was what the goal was with the pilot director, Gene Reynolds, and the writer, Larry Gelbart. They collaborated on this pilot. And, yeah, they really strove to give the show its own identity outside of the film while still being somewhat connected.
I think that's the mindset to go into. Of course, you want to make your own thing, but as long as, like, it's kind of like you're creating a cousin. As long, like, and you're adapting not only like the book, but you're adapting, like, this, it's been made into a movie. So how can you be different from the movie?
Yeah, you want to differentiate yourself, but still have the same appeal that made the film so popular.
And both of those guys were nominated for, like, I always love to bring up the nominations. Gene did not win for directing, but he did win the DGA award for directing, the Directors Guild. But I never knew, I never connected the dots with Larry Gelbart. He created a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, and he ended up writing Tootsie.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. So someone with just a lot of experience writing in film and television. And had a lot of very prolific work.
I could see now, like, the tonal balance with Tootsie.
Yeah. I mean, Tootsie is a classic, but, you know, it's very funny, but also very heartfelt. So, yeah, from what I understand, too, a lot of the cast was not as well known to TV viewers at the time. So, like, for example, Alan Alda did work mostly in theater and in Hollywood, but not in, like, the biggest productions before MASH. But as you said, he would go on to write 19 episodes, including the finale. So he became the face of the show, and not just on camera, but behind the camera as well. And then one of the actors who actually came back from the film is the actor Gary Berghoff, who reprises his role as Radar. I thought it was interesting. He's the one actor who was from the movie and was brought over to the show. And as you mentioned, a lot of the cast would change over the years. Even within this first episode, there's a character that's Father John Patrick Mulcahy?
Yeah,
Father Mulcahy is recast after this pilot. And then a lot of these recurring characters within the first season aren't brought onto the second one. So, yeah, it's interesting. The longevity of the show, you're really just following one character throughout all these different stories. But that it seems, at least in the first episode, there is a built-in friendship and almost like a buddy comedy with the characters of Hawkeye and Trapper.
It's basically us. This could have been us.
Really?
Like, this is basically us if we were doctors in the Korean War.
Oh, like, okay. I mean, they're very likable characters. But I do have, like, a couple of funny things to say about, like, their behavior and what they're able to get away with.
It's very 70s.
Yeah. Some things that they do don't really age that well, but we'll see as we get through that.
I was just saying that just because, like, when I never really watched MASH, and I was just amazed by Hawkeye. I'm like, I wish I could be that quick-witted in just every scenario ever.
Oh, yeah, and also just be so blasé in what is otherwise, like, a very serious situation that you're in the setting. The show was well-received. The pilot was well-received by the network, by critics, and despite its maybe middling viewership at the start, I think the network did see a lot of potential for it. So as I mentioned before, they moved it to a more advantageous time slot in the second season, and the rest is history. So it would run for 11 seasons and a total of 256 episodes. Woo. So just one of the hallmark programs in television history, certainly for the 70s and the early 80s. But let's go to the beginning, though. We're going to now say that it is September 17th, 1972. I will not be born for roughly another 19 years, but my parents are in middle school, so I'm not sure if they would have watched this first episode, but I'm sure they caught it at least later on. But yeah, so we're turning on CBS, and Keith, you can now take us to the pilot.
Flight 527, runway 8 Kilo, you're cleared for takeoff.
All right, so here we are in Korea, 1950, and there's a funny little joke of a caption, 100 years ago, which, you know, when this show aired, it was 12 years ago. Now, 1950 is 74 years ago. So within our lifetime, that funny caption will be true.
I had to look that up. I had to look up, like, why the joke. I'm like, I can, and it goes back to the Korean War being the forgotten war. It's just like, hey, like, for them, it's like, you know, if that came out in 1972, that's only like 22 years away. And people, I guess, weren't really talking about it. I'm sure, like,
22 years ago. Yeah. But you're right. With the Vietnam War, I guess it was kind of overshadowed, right? I mean, 1950, it's like less than 10 years since the end of World War II. So you're right. Yeah. It to be a forgotten war is an unfortunate thing as well, because, you know, obviously a lot of people died. But here we are. We're at this mobile army surgical hospital, and we see a lot of characters kind of going about their day very lightly. You know, there's like some hijinks going around here. You have characters throwing a football, playing golf. You see a couple of characters playing footsie with each other.
I had to laugh at when the father Mulcahy swipes away a fly. He does the sign of the cross.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like a lot of little moments, and yeah. I think that's a lot of the humor. Are quick cuts, quick moments, and you also have, I think, a moment of someone looking like they're about to fire a gun, but they're just opening a bottle of champagne, right? Some like misdirects there.
Captain Blake or Lieutenant Blake.
Yeah, Captain Blake.
Lieutenant Colonel Blake.
Colonel Blake. I don't know my army rankings, unfortunately.
But yeah, it's like a serious summer camp.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a very light feeling around this camp. But as Radar catches a football, he overhears the sound of helicopters approaching. And from what I'm understanding, I think it's like Radar is usually the first one to hear when there's something approaching the camp. So all of a sudden now we hear on the announcers there, those what do you call those things?
Like speaker? I call them like speaker.
On the speakers, those old like speaker air horn looking things, an announcement, you know, all personnel to their stations. You know, there's incoming soldiers that are going to need help. And so now you see you hear the theme song music coming in and all the characters running to where they're supposed to go, you know, grabbing these soldiers from the helicopters and bringing them into the tents, and you get the title card there, MASH. And the song I looked up, the theme song is an instrumental of a song called Suicide is Painless by Johnny Mandel. It's a very dark title, but I guess that is appropriate. I mean, the sound of it, it's like a very, I don't know, kind of like ominous sounding, right? It's light, but it's like, you know, it's an undertone of somberness.
Like something's about to happen.
Right, right.
But
like, you know,
yeah, I imagine CBS was not too happy to have a song, Suicide is Painless, as on their hit show. I think they just said, hey, use the instrumental. Like, you cannot use any lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what the lyrics are to this, but based on the title, I'm sure it's, you know, maybe unpleasant. But yeah, it definitely gives you a sense of uneasiness, right? Like, people are trying to keep their spirits up in what is otherwise a tough situation. So in the next scene, we're getting a little narration from Hawkeye. It's narrating a letter to his father about, you know, what he's doing there in the camp, and, you know, hoping his dad is proud of him. And we see in the tent here these doctors operating on injured soldiers. And we're getting a little bit of banter between two rival doctors. You have Hawkeye and then also Lieutenant Colonel Frank Burns. They're kind of snipping at each other here and trading some insults.
Yeah, Frank, you kind of get right away that he's kind of the tight ass of the group. The fuddy-duddy.
Yeah, the foil for your main characters here who are going to try to take things a little lighter. And so outside the surgery tent here, you know, Frank is berating Hawkeye. They're later joined by Margaret and John Trapper. So Frank and Margaret are telling Hawkeye and Trapper they're like a disgrace to the service. And, you know, Hawkeye and Trapper, they don't really take these guys too seriously. They're very flippant. They, you know, they joke that, you know, Frank is going to get caught with malpractice. You know, their body language, their sarcasm, you know, like whatever Frank has to say to them just kind of bounces right off. So you right away you get these two different groups of people here with totally different attitudes on their service. And even like Hawkeye says too, you know, like he mentions how he was drafted and that, you know, he wishes he hadn't opened that letter from President Truman. So I think that's interesting too. It's like there's like a reluctance here from Hawkeye, and he's going to be undermining a lot of the rules here at this camp.
Well, that's a big theme from both, like, I'm going to assume that carries on for the rest of the series, especially through Hawkeye and Trapper, but in the movie as well, just this like undermining authority.
Yeah, which, I mean, that was a big sentiment too at the time, 1972. People are, you know, protesting the war, and yeah, there's still a lot of hippies, you know, like, I don't know if it's still the hippie movement per se, but...
Well, you're right in the middle of it, like, you know, like...
Yeah, it was obviously still going on at the time the show started, so, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would watch this, and they might identify with Hawkeye as being this more rebellious character.
Your conduct in there was not only unbecoming an officer, it was equally reprehensible as a medical man.
Frank, I happen to be an officer only because I foolishly opened an invitation from President Truman to come to this costume party. And as for my ability as a doctor, if you seriously question that, I'm afraid I'll just have to challenge you to a duel.
Swords or pistols?
I was thinking of specimen bottles at 20 paces.
There are ladies present.
Oh, sorry, baby.
Major to you.
Why, sorry, Major, baby.
So now in the tent, in Hawkeye and Trapper's tent, we see Ho-John, who is like a houseboy, a local houseboy, serving them martinis in their tent. And, you know, they're joking about ending the war with the drinking contest. You know, they open some letters, and Trapper jokes about how, you know, he went to war to cheat on his wife. It's kind of a weird joke.
Well, that's one thing that you – everyone in this serious summer camp is horny.
Like, oh, yes, it yes.
Is, like, every, like, I underestimated the horniness of these two, especially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're like girl crazy, and they're always coming up with schemes that are somehow resulting in them getting with the woman. And they even they're very like transparent about it, too. So now Hawkeye gets news that Ho-John has been accepted to his alma mater. I guess he applied on his behalf, and all they have to do now is raise the tuition money, which is like $1,000, but really going to be closer to $2,000 after all the expenses. And so now they have to come up with an idea to raise the tuition money. And Hawkeye gets the idea to have a party where they will raffle off a prize. And that prize will ultimately be like a trip to Tokyo accompanied by one of the nurses. So interesting idea here. He's going to have to get approval for that, though.
It's not a pilot without a party.
That totally occurred to me too, man. It's like a drinking game. We should go through these different pilot formulas, right? Like, oh, take a drink if there's a party. So now in the next scene here, we meet Colonel Blake and Lieutenant Radar, and they have a funny sort of bit going on here where radar
it works
is,
for me. Of course, I've like seen it. This done many a time. And I, you know what? When it's done right, it's done right. And what these two have, it works. Yeah.
Radar is constantly anticipating Colonel Blake's orders. So every single time Colonel Blake gives an order, Radar's already done it, right? So, like, usually the formula will be like, you know, like, oh, like I sent out that letter you wanted me to. Oh, by the way, send out that letter I wanted you to. You know, like, there's like, Radar's always like one step ahead of Blake by like a second. Like, the timing of it is really, really good. Like, these guys have a really great comedic chemistry going on here. And, you know, it is like kind of old fashioned, but in like a pleasant way, right? Like the way Blake gets like constantly frustrated that he can't get a word out, that Radar's always like kind of outsmarting him. And there's a lot of really great physical comedy,
facial
comedy.
Like, I was, yeah, like, Henry, yeah. Blake, that actor really plays that, just like that kind of boss. Like, I'm not like a Mr. Burns or just like, he has that just airheadedness to him. Like,
mm-hmm. I get a sense that he's like kind of overwhelmed. Like, he has a lot of things on his plate. And so Radar is trying to be helpful by anticipating what he wants. But at the same time, Blake, he wants to maintain his authority. He wants to give the order before Radar carries it out.
Basically.
You know, and so that's a source of frustration for him there. So it's a fun bit that I was enjoying throughout the episode. So then Hawkeye and Trapper come in. They're proposing their raffle idea to Blake, who, yeah, he's a little suspicious, but he's like, okay, maybe that's not a bad idea. And the nurse that Hawkeye has in mind for this raffle prize is a nurse named Dish. And we get a flashback here to all these moments where Hawkeye is kind of creeping on her. Like, he's always sneaking up on her and trying to seduce her or be like intimate with her. And she's insisting she's engaged. And this is for me where it gets, it doesn't age too well here. Like, Hawkeye's a little handsy with this nurse.
Sure. I mean, like, they do seem to have that, like,
I mean, it's all good fun, I guess.
That's how I'm kind of, like, it's, she goes, you know, I'm engaged, and he's like, I'm just, you know, I'm a rough draft, or, but it seems like they do have a flirtation.
There's chemistry, like, between the two, which maybe she's, like, playing a little coy, and he's enjoying this sort of...
Like, they do dance, they dance later on, they, like, she smiles at him, but not, like, I think just...
It's like a game, you know, like they're playing like a little game here, which I guess like in today's lens might come off as a little creepy, but it seems like there's nothing really malicious about it. It's just it's like a very sort of lighthearted like cat and mouse game that they're in.
I think just to set up like both Hawkeye and Trapper with both of these, like, it. Of course, like, you know, of course how this ages, you know, we kind of can't control it. But I'm sure at the, like, Hawkeye is really charming and Trapper is too. But Trapper is more like, I don't care who I have back home. Like, he's more like rambunctious with it, or reckless, I should say. He's more like, if these two friends, he's more of the Huckleberry Finn and Hawkeye's the more Tom Sawyer.
Oh, OK. That's a good,
like,
way to
put it. There's a charm that Alan Alda has. Like, even when he pops out of the duffel bag, he gives her like the cute eyes. Like, he's handsy, but it's not.
It's like a little kid, you know.
It's
that's
like a
what,
little kid, and I think
it's
audiences
very
once
silly.
Again, audiences like grew to love Alan Alda and Hawkeye. I think they would. No one warned me about this show. I'll say that. No one said like, oh, like there's no, like, I didn't get the like. Person in the beginning of the show talking about how times have changed, but like I could see, of course, everything, like, jokes like this will age differently.
Right. There's no disclaimer necessary for this, you know, like, oh, you might say something that makes you uncomfortable. No, that's not really the case. And like, again, it's played for laughs, and the expressions that Alan Alda is delivering in this is definitely lighthearted. It's, you know, it's surface level chuckles.
What all these people want more than anything else?
To go home, or Tokyo, whichever comes first.
What do they really want?
Sex. except for those baseball perverts.
Let Radar print up some tickets, and you make up a sign.
Mind telling me what we're going to put on the sign?
All you can drink, $10 a head. Giant door prize, weekend pass for two in Tokyo. Lucky winner to share the company of a gorgeous nurse.
Now in the next scene here, Hawkeye is trying to find some more money for the tuition. You know, they're raising money, but not quite enough yet. And he starts like going through Frank's belongings through his Bible, looking for like loose dollars, I guess. And, you know, Frank comes in, he's mad about this, and they get into a little bit of a tussle. Frank grabs their gin mill and winds up dropping it and destroying it. And not the gin. And in response, Trapper and Hawkeye, they put a sack over Frank and shove him out of the tent. And you know what? There's like a quick moment here that really made me laugh. After they shove him out and slam the door, Hawkeye says, thought he'd never leave. And it's like such a quick moment. Like there's a pacing in these 70s comedies, like that, for example, that really get me. You know, they're like, it's so fast that it takes me like a delayed reaction to like realize what happened. So I like that. And that's why I wish there wasn't a laugh track, because, you know, I don't feel like you need to be told when to laugh when you're watching this. I think the jokes are very clear. And, you know, if you let the show rely more on those sort of quick edits and cuts, it would be more effective.
Yeah. All this delivery is great. Just with all the quips that he has.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's really in control of all these scenes here, and, you know, knowing exactly the timing and the delivery of each joke. So now we have to go back to Colonel Blake's office, and he's chewing out Hawkeye and Trapper for their treatment.
They got Frank. Told on.
Yeah, yeah, right. And Colonel Blake now has to cancel the party as punishment, but he also mentions that he has to leave camp for the weekend. So Hawkeye and Trapper look at each other like, okay. They're gonna plot to still have their party while he's gone. And so, you know, as now we see Blake getting in a helicopter to leave camp, I forget what the reason why is. Like, he has to meet up with someone somewhere else.
He's meeting up with, like, his boss, General Hammond.
Oh, General Hammond. Okay, and we'll meet him a little later. But as he's flying off in his helicopter, you know, the Hawkeye and Trapper, they're waving him goodbye, knowing that they're going to still pull off their party. And Radar hands them a couple of signed passes that he tricked Blake basically into signing. Apparently he thought he was signing an order for ice cream. That was pretty good. So again, like, that's Radar, like, knowing his colonel well enough to not just anticipate his needs, but also into tricking him to fulfill whatever scheme that is going on. It seems like these guys are gonna be able to get away with their plan here for the raffle, but then another announcement comes on the speaker, and Frank is now announced as the acting commander, and he has canceled all activities outside of duty.
I think from this first act, you totally get the like kids in summer camp feel, how they treat Frank, how they kick Frank out, just like, you know, the boys going after the girls and every, like, I think even in the beginning, during that montage, you saw like, men personnel only, and you see a woman kind of sneak out and a man. It's very much like, oh, the camp counselor's going away. Oh, who's in charge?
The tattletale's in charge. You know, like, that's, yeah, you're very right. It's a very similar dynamic.
I'm okay with like the classic sitcom scenarios.
Yeah.
But when they're the first and they're done so well, it's, I really do like the, like, when I'm having fun, man.
I agree. It is a fun pilot. And I think another smart thing they do to help us familiarize ourselves with these characters so quickly is that they all seem to be paired off, right? So you have Hawkeye and Trapper, like your leads here, you're going to be following. And then you have like Blake paired with Radar. And so then you also have
Hot Lips and
Hot Lips Markets, aka Hot Lips, paired with Frank. And each pairing is kind of having their own little subplots there and their own like dynamic. So I think that's a good way, like, you know, when you group characters in different ways, it's a really smart way to introduce the audience into, you know, what the overall dynamic is between everyone else. So Now we have an act break. And when we come back from commercial, we have a scene here where the doctors are checking on patients. Hawkeye asks Frank to check on one particular patient with this stethoscope. And while he leans over, Hawkeye injects him with some sort of drug. I don't know. A sedative, I guess.
Random sedative.
Totally knocks him out. And I guess it's a funny moment. Like, the actor who plays Frank has a funny facial expression as he's drugged. And the other doctors who are in on the plan here, they grab him. They wrap him up in bandages. And Hawkeye even, says, oh, I recommend we sedate him every hour. So he's taken out here, Frank, and put somewhere where he won't be able to interfere with the plans. So now we go right to the party. We see everyone in the camp coming into this party. It's like, I don't know, some sort of tropical theme. They have Lays and Hawaiian shirts, it seems. We have Dish and Hawkeye dancing with each other. But Margaret comes in. She is furious because she knows that this party was supposed to be canceled. And she confronts Hawkeye. And again, he's very flippant about her threats, right? Like, he's like, well, what are you gonna do? And so she's determined to find Frank and have Hawkeye be punished.
And
so,
this is the first time we do hear him call her Hot Lips. And I'm not just saying beautiful woman, but her character is known as Hot Lips throughout the course of the series. And I think she stayed on for a very long time, if not the whole run.
Yeah, from what I understand, she is the
she even won second, Emmys from it. Like,
she's the character who appears in the second most amount of episodes after Hawkeye.
Yeah, she won, I think, 2 Emmys from it. So I'm not everyone called her Hot Lips.
Yeah, which is interesting because your first impression of this character is someone like Frank, who seems to be very much strictly obeying the rules and is actually kind of cold. Like, how does she get the name Hot Lips if she seems so stern? And so I'm curious to learn her backstory and also to see maybe the evolution of this character as she maybe lightens up a little bit. And I feel like she would probably be a fascinating development over the course of the show, especially if she's in so many episodes.
Well, on top of all that, it's funny that, she's a fuddy-duddy too. Mm-hmm. But the fuddy-duddies, they're on their own island, but they do kind of have their own fling going. They're playing footsies. She obviously, is taking his back or his side in a lot of things.
Right. She's backing Frank up because they have some sort of secret romance. There's even an earlier scene. I think it was during that flashback when Hawkeye is pursuing Dish. You also see that Margaret and Frank are watching them with their binoculars.
Right. Oh,
right?
Yeah. And it's not that they're hypocrites. It's it's just so, I'm going to keep saying it, a serious summer camp. Like, it really does have that feel
you have the rivalries.
Bit of that show Recess a little bit. But
what was the one on Nickelodeon? Salute Your Shorts, right? You have, different rivalries. You have different archetypes here. You know, rule breakers, rule followers. Margaret, she goes off to try to look for Frank and eventually finds him. And she's so upset of the state he's in that she calls General Hammond. And at first he doesn't recognize the name when he's told, oh, you have a call from a Margaret so-and-so. And he's like, who? And then when he picks up the phone, he goes, oh, Hot Lips. And we get a flashback to them having a little bit of a fling at some other point in time. I'm not sure when.
This flashback made me laugh because it really just starts it's so quick. And it's just them looking at each other and then just embracing, knocking over stuff.
Yeah, you know what it reminded me of? I feel like it was almost like a parody of some of these medical soap operas that
yeah,
have those kind of moments, right? And I also want to mention too, we're not going to be talking about any soap operas during this series on the medical genre.
There's 1,000 episodes, so how do you start?
Right, to talk about a general hospital or something. But I think I like that this show, MASH, is nodding to that genre and making fun of it a bit.
Captain Pierce.
Oh, I'm sorry, honey. My dance card's all full.
Where is he?
Who?
You know very well who. Major Burns. He's been missing for hours.
Boy, I thought you'd heard.
Heard what?
Frank's gone over to the enemy. But you offered him $100 more a week and a royalty on bedpans.
Okay, so Hawkeye now is going to be announcing the winner of the raffle. And the winner winds up being the priest, Father Mulcahy.
Well, but you just can see the yeah. card is taped because Dish was worried. Dish was worried that I don't want to have to go to Tokyo for a weekend with another guy, right? And she doesn't want to go with him, with Hawkeye necessarily. And Hawkeye's like, "Don't worry, I got it covered." And so you can kind of see the tape card in the front.
Oh, I missed that. So I think there was a shot.
The safest yeah. person to go to Tokyo with is the priest.
Right, right. There was a shot of this bowl with all the entries, and you kind of see the bottom of it and the hand going through. So I wasn't really sure what that was. But okay, I missed that, but I'm glad you brought that up. So, but as this is being announced, General Hammond arrives. Radar hears this before anyone else and goes to greet him and doesn't realize he's wearing like a toilet seat on his head. I guess it's like a party thing. Like people are wearing funny hats. So like it's a little embarrassing. And so Hammond comes in and he like starts to break up this party here, and he demands to know who's responsible for this. And he gets like a little confrontational with Hawkeye here, who's again kind of like mocking him a bit, like, who are you? Like, he mocks the stars, on Hammond's uniform. Like, what does that mean? You're like Tinkerbell or something? And Hammond is absolutely furious. He like tells Hawkeye that he's going to be court-martialed, he's going to be like prosecuted. And this is just as Frank and Margaret are coming in to see the fallout from this. This is where Hammond addresses Margaret as Hot Lips, much to her embarrassment.
And both Trapper and Hawkeye look at each other like, wow, that's not just us calling her that. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's and a worldwide like, nickname.
There's so many like quick moments in this too. Like as Frank and Margaret are approaching and Frank's has some bandages on, like Hawkeye's like, oh, the mummy, it's awakened. Like he's, Hawkeye is objectively in a lot of trouble here, but he's not really concerned at all.
And
right?
I think there's a reason for that, which will, because I think he I wonder if he ever gets like any comeuppance, and I'm not saying he should, but he kind of has this all laid out. Like he's like, he feels invincible. Like he can get away with this because,
well, he kind of can.
Well, another thing about characters in a pilot staple, both Trapper and Hawkeye especially are very good at their jobs. Very good at their jobs, but,
that's their shield.
Hot Lips does chide when she's chiding Hawkeye about the party. He goes, I'm not drinking because I got word that the Canadians are in a bad fight, and a bunch of them are coming over here around midnight. So we're going to have this party and then things are going to get serious. So he knows that they need him.
Right, right. That's a good point. And so he brings that up again. When Hammond is, again, threatening that he will be court-martialed, and Hawkeye reasons with him, like, listen, that can all wait. Right now, there are helicopters coming in, and we're actually kind of short-staffed here. So, we all need to be working on this right now. You can't afford to take us out of duty. And they even convince Hammond to help out as well.
That's how you win. And like that, like, it's just like it. Winning, like that's like you get to have your cake and eat it too, because like they ask Hammond, like, oh, is your hand still steady? Like, yeah, you invite the guy who was about to like court martial you to join in.
Yeah, right. You win him over to your side. I mean, they did make a great first impression with the general by insulting his uniform and pretending being very blasé about the whole situation. But yeah, this is where they're able to change his opinion. It should also be noted, too, that as they were announcing the winner of the raffle, they also announced that they were able to raise enough money for Ho-John's tuition. So mission accomplished.
He's going to college, baby.
Eventually. So now we have a quick scene of the doctors operating on these soldiers. It's like a quick shot that you were left to imagine that they're working overnight, because then the next scene, it is morning, and you see the characters leaving the operating tent. We see Blake and Hammond. Hammond is very impressed by Hawkeye and Trapper. He tells Blake, hold on to those two. Don't lose them. Not even to me. And then we get one last bit here.
They're untouchable. Like...
Right, right. It just goes to show you can get away with anything if you're good at your job. So yeah, there's another quick gag here with Radar and Blake, right? Where like Radar hands Blake a box of cigars just as Blake says, "Oh, hand me a box of cigars to give to the general." You know, so that gag continues. And so, yeah, after Hammond leaves, very impressed, Hawkeye and Trapper exit. They have already handcuffed themselves to each other. Like, all right, we're ready to be court-martialed. But Blake tells him, nope, like, you impressed him. You're too good at your job to be arrested. And, you know, Blake is actually kind of a little put off by this, right? Because he knows these two, and he's aware that this was their plan all along. So, you know, I can tell Blake is a little resentful that these two act like they're above the rules and they're not really punished for their behavior.
And it won't be the last time either.
Right, right. I get a sense probably in this first season, this is an episodic occurrence. So, that we have the last bit here where Hawkeye and Trapper are joking about how, you know, they're never going to get out of this place because they're too good at their job. They joke about, you're sabotaging their work, so they get kicked out, right? And then they try walking after a couple of the nurses there, but you know, their handcuffs kind of like cause a little bit of physical comedy. And
helicopter shot, like you get like a I don't think I've ever seen that, or anyone at that point has seen a helicopter shot in a sitcom
on television, right? Like for something on the smaller screen. And so yeah, that's your last shot. There's like overpanning shot of the two of them continuing their little handcuff joke, and that's it. That's MASH. And then, you know, there's like the credits I thought were funny. It's like a stylized credits where we hear that announcer voice going on reading off the names of the cast members. And also like a credit sequence that is very much in the style of the 70s with the music, the font of the credits, right? Like it's just so of the time. It makes you feel like you're going back into a bygone era. And there you have it. That is the first episode of MASH.
Those two maniacs are the best surgeons I've ever seen. Made me feel like a horse doctor in there. Now make sure you don't lose them.
Hey, where's he going? We're all set.
Forget it. He was too impressed to have you arrested.
He did it again. Screwed up in reverse.
I keep telling you, we got to give up this preoccupation with keeping people alive or we'll never get out of here.
So, okay, what do you think, Keith? Like, I want to decide if we want to review this like retrospectively or imagine that we are, you know, our age in 1972 and like, oh, like, do we want to continue watching this show? Are we impressed? Is this something that we would continue watching? And I would think I would be impressed by something that is seemingly breaking the mold.
I think, okay, if we do, we could kind of do both, but one
not seemingly, it is, I think, breaking the mold. So like it's fresh in that regard, you know, it's very different for what all the other comedies were doing at the time.
That, and it's just like, okay, we put ourselves back in time, 100%. It seemed to be the show that everyone was watching, and like with the three channels, like, yeah, it just seems like that was like the golden age of television in some way, or whatever age they call it.
I would say it's like
the first golden age.
Right. I would say it's like a golden age in terms of broadcast television. How about that, right?
Yes.
Because a lot of times the 2010s are referred to the golden age of television from a content standpoint. But for the broadcasters, I think it was certainly the 70s because they were able to put out a lot of progressive content while, you know, still appealing to their, you know, their faithful audience, right? Like they had still broad appeal while still able to like reflect the changing attitudes of the times. And, you know, just being part of the culture, you know, like that's important too. Like they could be content maybe to just put out the same things over and over again. I'm sure there were a lot of shows that weren't really breaking the mold, but to put out something like MASH, it's like they had the power to do that when they didn't necessarily have to, but it's a good thing they did because I think this is such a predecessor to many great comedies afterwards, many great medical dramas afterwards, right? They tried so many different things. From what I understand, they played around with the format a lot towards the end of the show. You know, they experimented.
You had spinoffs.
Like
you had successful spinoffs. Apparently, Trapper went on for 7 seasons, and after MASH, which I think was I don't know how long that went on, but I always heard that was like one of those like spin-off shows. But I'm going to give 2 reviews, one for myself and one for the audience. One for myself, and what I mean by that is I think for me and maybe us too as students of television, I know at least I owe it to myself to watch MASH, like just to witness these moments of not only television, great television writing and acting, but also these moments of just pop culture history. And I just, as a fan of sitcoms and something like this, the first episode did make me laugh. I did watch the second, made me laugh. I'm not going to say I'm going to binge it, but I would like to say at least at one point in my life, I would like to get through MASH.
You know, it's quite an undertaking, you know, 256 episodes. And I'm sure that as you get to the later seasons, it would probably be something you'd be less inclined to binge because the material gets so much heavier.
But I already have so many shows on my docket, not only from like this, like I do like the balancing act that I do with all the shows, not only from this podcast, but just shows I just want to watch in general. But I think I just owe it to myself to watch MASH. And that would lead me into my next review just for anybody. If this pilot did anything for you, I think it's a show worth taking. I think it's a flight worth taking. Just because I think you will get the highs and lows. I think if you like Scrubs, I think you would like this. But it's, you know, this show is now going to be 52 years old. If it's this good still, it's nice to continue the legacy. It's nice for it to have a reason for it to be on the Mount Rushmore of television.
Yeah, I'm grateful that it's accessible, right? It's on Hulu. All the episodes are there. I can see this being a show I watch maybe in the morning with a cup of coffee. That's how I treat a lot of older shows, right? Like
I think that's fair.
There was a time I was like watching like the first season or so of The Golden Girls. That was like a morning show. And so like for this, if I were to continue, yeah, I think it would be something I'd watch maybe like 1 or 2 at a time. And, you know, I think you're right. I'd love to honor this, you know, these legacy programs. Because I don't think we'd have so much great content if it wasn't for something like this. I think also the success of the show is really predicated on not just the writing, but just Alan Alda being so charming. I mean, he is so playful in this first episode, and to balance that playfulness with the seriousness of being an army doctor in the middle of a war, I mean, that's hard to do. But it's like one of those things, like you said, in Scrubs, where like the characters don't take themselves seriously, but they take their work very seriously. And I think that's very important. There's the human element, and there's still the lighthearted stuff that wins us over and brings us back.
But yeah, no, it's definitely like if you were to maybe not, I'm trying to think, like if you put it at the top of a pyramid, you could see all the other shows that it has influenced. Like you've seen... If you've watched Family Guy, they've made fun of MASH, or they've had MASH
references. Lot of MASH references.
Same thing with Simpsons. That's probably where I learned the pop culture osmosis of like just what happened in MASH. But you could see just the influence that this show had on just probably American culture, I would say.
Yeah, big part of it. And you're right. We owe ourselves as big students of television, fans of television, to maybe go down the road with this, you know, somewhat, right?
It is a journey. It is a journey, and I don't see myself binging it. But like you said, maybe one a day or a couple a week.
Maybe even like one era at a time too, right? Because the cast changes so much. Yeah, you know, from what I understand, I think after season 3, there's like a big change and a lot of cast members depart. So maybe like watch up to a certain season, take a little time, come back to it for like the next phase of the show, for example. I think for a show that has been around for so many episodes, you want to break it up a little bit.
For a show that's been on like 11 years. I always have to laugh that like for shows that are on like, you know, 5, 6, you know, 7 years, that someone could binge it in a week is so funny to me. And granted, that's their way of experiencing it. But, you know, when you talk to someone like who's been a lifelong fan, how they had to wait years, how like all these discussions, and then someone's just like, oh yeah, I just watched that last week.
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, think about it too, the old fashioned way of watching TV, one episode a week over the course of years. That's why you feel so attached to the characters too, because you have more time to think about each episode and you feel like you were with them for so much longer. Like they're a part of your life for so much longer, for all those years. And then also like the breaks in between seasons, you know, like the longevity of that, it's you stretch all those episodes over 11 years and it's significant. People really grew emotionally attached to the stories.
To have 106 million people watch the finale, I think that's that, you know, I don't even know what grade to give that. I think A plus would be an understatement.
Yeah, it's just a massive achievement. That I'm glad it went to an innovative show like this. But yeah, this is just the beginning. It's going to be hard. It's a tough act to follow, but we have a lot of other great hospital shows, medical shows that we're going to be covering as well. So we'd like to go in chronological order as well. So we're going to be jumping to the 80s for our next show, which is going to be Saint Elsewhere. So that show, I think, falls more into like a little more abstract at times.
I only know about the finale.
Me too.
Like, and the fact that like Denzel Washington was on it, I just know that's the only thing I know.
I don't know very much about it either, so I'm curious if that also wins us over as well as the MASH pilot did. We shall see. But I'm glad we're getting off to a healthy start here. I'll try to think of more doctor puns as we go along. But yeah, we're our doctor's note. We have many more prescriptions to fill. So Keith, we'll catch you at the next pilot. Follow us on Instagram and X, formerly Twitter, at Take Us to the Pilot. That's Take Us to the Pilot with the number 2.
Attention passengers, we've now reached our destination. We hope you enjoyed the flight and have a nice day.